Well, as 2021 continues to proceed, there is still things that are happening that are showing a little more normalcy, returning back to normalcy in our year. Not to say that COVID is over or that we should take it for granted or take it lightly, but there is something nice to see things like the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade is actually supposed to happen this year since it was took a year off from last year. There's something a little bit satisfying about that. You know, parades like that take our minds off of what's wrong and turns us for at least an hour or two to lightness. And as we look at the floats and the balloons, maybe a little whimsy. You know, this can actually happen on a grand and global scale as something as a Macy's Day, Thanksgiving Day Parade. Or maybe as simple as the parade at the Avenue White Marsh when they do the holiday parade and the tree lighting ceremony, which will be this year on Saturday, December 4th. You know, after all, it has been said many times that everybody loves a parade. Unfortunately, there are some people who seem that it's their life's mission to rain on our parade at times too, isn't it? You know, parades have been around for as long as there has been written history. And they are typically reserved for special occasions or to recognize achievement for an individual or a group. They have been used to bring nations together, to build communities over an event that should be celebrated. In more recent years and more recent times, the pinnacle of one's achievement would have been honored with what is known as a ticker tape parade in New York City. And this is what a typical ticker tape parade looked like in the mid-20th century. Isn't that amazing? Kind of looks like my house after Christmas morning. Yeah, the ticker tape parades in New York City actually started kind of spontaneously when there was the dedication of the Statue of Liberty in the 1880s. The parade got formed all on its own, and people in the offices were watching the parade go by, and they grabbed rolls of the ticker tape, which were used in what was a ticker tape machine that kept stock information for the companies as it's coming out from the stock exchange. And they just took it and threw it out the windows. Just let it unspool all the way down to the ground. That's why you see it kind of going down. It's like toilet paper in somebody's house, but with good intentions and not bad. Now they use mostly confetti to do this. And boy, can you imagine cleaning up all of that? The ticker tape parades have been used for a variety of things, for politicians, for Olympians, for sports teams, for astronauts. They were used to kind of celebrate achievement. Even in the Bible, we find parades, and sometimes they're good and sometimes they're bad. But when we think of a good parade, especially in the Old Testament, probably what might come to mind if we really press our minds a little bit and think parade in the Old Testament, we would probably think of David leading the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem. Jerusalem was the new capital city. David was seeking to unite all 12 tribes solidly as one nation with one capital, one king, and one God. And as they were bringing the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem, he danced before the procession as the people celebrated. And today, we're going to see kind of a distant echo of that same idea of David in Nehemiah chapter 12. We started this journey in Ezra and Nehemiah back in April 18th. And for the most part, have continued through. We took a couple of little breaks here and there, but for the most part, we've been focused on going through and looking at these two amazing books and understanding the leadership that was involved in bringing about the completion of the temple, the rededication of the temple, and the rededication of the Jerusalem walls. And we're down to our final two Sundays of looking at these two books, looking at the book of Nehemiah. And Today we're looking at really a celebration service in chapter 12. Now, Ezra opened up with the Jewish exiles returning to Jerusalem around 535 B.C. And in chapter 12 of Nehemiah, we see the dedication of the completed walls of Jerusalem, and this happened about 433 B.C., so almost an exact 100 years to get the work done. The temple being restored, temple dedicated, to the walls being rebuilt, the city repopulated, and now to the dedication. A lot of things have happened to hinder them. There was food shortage, labor shortage, adversaries that sought to sabotage the work. The people were compromising their beliefs with whom they married or those leaders that they supported that they certainly shouldn't have been supporting. Not everything was great still, even though they were excited. They were still not an independent nation. They were still under the rule of Persia, and Persia collected a hefty tax from them. However, they recognized the opportunities, even in the midst of that, to celebrate. The temple had been rebuilt and dedicated. Worship services had resumed. The city walls that were completely destroyed and as gates that were had been completely burned were rebuilt. Revival broke out among the people to such an extent that they made a covenant with one another and with God that they would live according to His word. And when it came time to repopulate the city of Jerusalem, they devised a system where they took 10% of those who were living outside in those villages to leave their comfortable homes, their way of life, and to move into the city where life would be harder, and they willingly went. What we are seeing is that the city of Jerusalem was becoming a political, religious, and economic hub for the people. It was indeed becoming the capital of those living in the area. And Jerusalem had become the center of these returned leaders for both religious and political reasons. Now, chapter 12 begins with a listing of the religious leaders who came with Zerubbabel and who had served through the major periods of the children of Israel's return. And it demonstrates the legitimacy and the authority that the religious leaders had at the time. But it also demonstrated the legitimacy of the faith community. They were people who were chosen, who were set apart as religious leaders and as a people to lead in the worship of the one true God, which brings us to our text today. And we'll begin reading in verse 27. At the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, the Levites were sought out from where they lived and were brought to Jerusalem to celebrate joyfully the dedication with songs of thanksgiving and with the music of cymbals, harps, and lyres. The musicians also were brought together from the region around Jerusalem, from villages of the Netophathites, from Beth Gilgal, and from the area of Geba and Azmaveth, for the musicians had built villages for themselves around Jerusalem. When the priests and Levites had purified themselves ceremonially, they purified the people, the gates, and the wall. So the repopulation of Jerusalem and the establishment of the people would lead to the nation to in worship. It serves as our backdrop for the rededication of the walls. The Levites and the musicians, they lived in villages outside of the city, and when there was their time to perform or to conduct their service in the temple, they would just come into the city. From basically what we would call today as the suburbs. Now here, all of them were being sought to come back, as many as possible for this great time of celebration. But before the dedication would take place, the Levites and the priests, they had to go through purification rites that would symbolically show that they were forgiven of their sin, that they were being cleansed of their sins. And after this, they too would then symbolically cleanse the people of their sins, setting apart the people, the gates, and the walls for God's holy purposes. Next, the parade begins. Look at this procession along the walls. I had the leaders of Judah go up on top of the wall. I also assigned two large choirs to give thanks. One was to proceed on top of the wall to the right, toward the dung gate. Hoshea and half of the leaders of Judah followed them, along with Azariah, Ezra, Meshulam, Judah, Benjamin, Shemaiah, Jeremiah, as well as some priests with trumpets. Priests with trumpets. Well, we don't have priests with trumpets, but we do have a pastor with a trombone. And if you don't watch yourself, I might actually play it. If I see anybody dozing off, that's when I'll play it. So the priest with the trumpets, and also Zechariah, son of Jonathan, the son of Shemaiah, the son of Mattaniah, the son of Micaiah, the son of Zachar, the son of Asaph and his associates, Shemaiah, Azrael, Meliah, Gelilah, Maiah, Nathaniel, Judah, and Hanani, with musical instruments prescribed by David, the man of God. So just get this here. So you have priests with trumpets going before, and those would have been the shofars, the big horn, you know, ram's horn. They would have been going before, and then these musicians, they would have lyres and cymbals, and they would be following, and harps, and they would be following behind. And at the fountain gate, and Ezra, the teacher of the law, led the procession. So here's Ezra. Nehemiah and Ezra are present. Ezra's leading that procession. At the fountain gate, they continued directly up the steps to the city of David on the ascent to the wall and passed above the site of David's palace to the water gate on the east. The second choir proceeded in the opposite direction. I, Nehemiah, followed them on top of the wall together with half the people, past the Tower of the Ovens to the broad wall, over the gate of Ephraim, the Jeshana gate, the fish gate, the Tower of Hanael, and the Tower of the Hundred. As far as the sheep gate, at the gate of the guard, they stopped. So not quite the processional that we would normally see in a parade. Nehemiah divided them in two, set them to walk the top of the walls in opposite direction. Ezra led one group, Nehemiah followed the other. The two groups walking were walking along the city to declare God and his holy purposes. The two large choirs led the people in giving thanks for all that God had done. They were all focusing on what God had done for them. I want you to just think for just a moment what that must have been, what must have been going through Nehemiah's mind. 12 years earlier, he had heard of the terrible condition of Jerusalem, and his heart broke, and he sought opportunity to go to Jerusalem to rebuild the walls, to rebuild the city. And the king granted him that permission. And then when he arrived, he went along the walls secretly at night with just a few people. And all he saw was utter destruction and utter ruin. And he said in chapter 2 of Nehemiah, "You see the trouble we are in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates burn. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision." His request has now been fulfilled. And so instead of riding along destroyed walls and burned out gates, he's riding along restored walls and gates that are steadfast in their place. There had to be deep satisfaction as he was listening to the people praise and thank God for all that what he had done. Even though he knew that the completion of the walls meant that he had to return to Persia, return to the king. The two choirs in verse 40, the two choirs that gave thanks then took their places in the house of God. So did I, together with half the officials, as well as the priest, Eliakim, Messiah, Minamin, Micaiah, Ilonai, Zechariah, and Hananiah with their trumpets. And also Messiah, Shemaiah, Eleazar, Uzi, Jehoanan, Malachah, Elam, and Ezer. The choir sang under direction of Jezariah. And on that day they offered great sacrifices, rejoicing because God had given them great joy. The women, the children also rejoiced. The sound of rejoicing in Jerusalem would be heard far away. The two groups circled until they reunited, and they reunited at the temple of God. And the occasion was just marked by unrestrained joy. They expressed their sacrifices made and the songs sung in such a way that the people in the neighboring countries could hear them. They could hear this worship service. They could hear the final shout of joy as the walls were being dedicated. Then verse 44. At that time, men were appointed to be in charge of the storerooms for the contribution. First fruits of tithes from the fields around the towns they were to bring into the storerooms, the portions required by the law for the priests and the Levites. For Judah was pleased with the ministering priests and Levites. They performed the service of their God and the service of purification, as did also the musicians and gatekeepers, according to the commands of David and his son Solomon. You just notice that they're being very careful, making sure they're doing things according to the word of God and according to what David and Solomon had done. They're taking extra caution here. For long ago in the days of David and Asaph, there had been directors for the musicians and for the songs of praise and thanksgiving to God. So in the days of Zerubbabel and of Nehemiah, all of Israel contributed the daily portions for the musicians and the gatekeepers. They also set aside a portion for other Levites, and the Levites set aside a portion for the descendants of Aaron. So after this dedication, as Nehemiah is getting ready to head back to Persia, he's setting up a process. He's setting up ongoing support for the work of God, for both those who are serving in the temple area and for the ministry itself through the offerings that would be made. All of it was in line with God's word. It is through this parade and this amazing worship celebration that we should take some note of how we should approach worship when we come together on Sundays, and how we can make it more of a celebration and more meaningful and express more gratitude. And the first thing that we have to recognize is that we, as Christ followers, are called to be set apart. We're not to be like the world. We are to be sanctified. We are sanctified and set apart for God's use. The people in Nehemiah's day demonstrated that they would be the people who followed his word and would live differently. And the Apostle Paul challenges us with the very same thing in Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, where he says this: "Therefore I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good and perfect will." We are urged to offer our bodies as living sacrifice. And to Paul's readers, this would have been a little bit of an odd thing. So whether you were Jewish or you're part of the pagan religions in Rome, offerings were usually animals that were sacrificed. Offerings were dead things that were burnt up. And here he's not talking about dead offerings, but he's talking about living offerings. One that stays alive, that is alive. You know, in the New Testament, it teaches us that Jesus Christ died once and for all on the cross. He who knew no sin became sin for us, so that we might become the righteousness of God. Therefore, there is no need for additional sacrifices. He completed that. He offered the perfect sacrifice. Nothing else is needed. So instead of offering a sacrifice, Paul is telling us that we should be the sacrifice. We're not to be burnt on offering, but a living one. And the idea of offer actually means to stand beside, you know, presenting. You're standing beside the offering. So when it says about standing beside, it means, in other words, whatever we do in our body, all of our activities, all of our habits, all of the choices that we make should stand beside Christ. So instead of viewing obedience as just something we do for Jesus, we should see it as something that we do with Jesus. We offer our bodies, our eyes, our ears, our mouth, our lips, our hands, our feet, our heart, our mind, in service with him and fulfilling God's will. So what does that look like? What does it mean? Okay, if we're a sacrifice, what else does that mean? If we're set apart, the second thing that we need to understand is that we are also to offer praise. In Hebrews chapter 13, verse 15, the writer writes, through Jesus, let us continually offer to God a sacrifice of praise, the fruit of lips that openly profess his name. Now, we all agree that our behavior is very important. And sometimes people listen to our behavior more than our words. But they need to hear our words, too. People don't know that Jesus died for them and that they need to confess their sins and profess Christ as Lord and Savior unless somebody tells them that. But they also should hear what we're grateful for and what we're thankful for. Usually the world is, the conforming part of the world is griping and complaining. But as Christ followers, we should find what God is doing and share what he has done. So words are needed, because silence doesn't lead people to trust Christ. At some point, we have to tell people why we believe what we believe. 1 Peter chapter 3, 15 says that in your hearts, revere Christ as the Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. And as I mentioned, words are important, but they're not enough. Either we have to have the right behavior, we need to back them up. And the Hebrew text here in the very next verse tells us that it says this, and do not forget to do good and to share with others, for with such sacrifices God is pleased. So we're actually to do good to all people, to seek opportunities to bless them, to seek opportunities to help them, to seek opportunities to be their friend, demonstrating that we don't work by the same rules as the world. And then finally, when we enter worship, we should expect to support that worship through the resources that we have. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 17 to verse 19 says this, command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life. You know, let's just be honest for a moment. You know, most of us probably really don't think of ourselves as wealthy, but by the world standards, in this present world, we're pretty wealthy. We live in this country, we're pretty wealthy. Maybe not all of us, but certainly most of us. The average person in the world makes $10,298 a year. So that takes the rich countries and the poor countries in together. One of the lowest median incomes is $298 a year. I don't even know how you begin to live a week on $298, much less a whole year on $298. You know, we need to look at how God has blessed us. It's not so that we can keep accumulating, and we certainly want to be careful and not frivolous with our money, and we want to provide for, you know, security and retirement, and we're not talking about that. But if we would just stop and take a moment and look at our disposable income and how we could use that to better, to support the work of God, to support, to minister those who are in need. Allowing God's generosity to flow through us to others. So when we do come each week to worship, we should make it celebratory, that we recognize that, first of all, this is a joy. We should be excited to do it. It's an opportunity to be set apart at a set time with one another who are called by God's people, by God's name. That we belong together, that we belong to God and we belong to one another, because we are living sacrifices. We should come with the expectation of sharing the praises and the thanksgiving that we have for the week that God has given us, and telling people what God has done. And let that be the first thing that we share with those around us. We should anticipate that we'll discover a way that we can do good to those that are around us, and to do good to those that we come in contact with during the week. And we should come open and ready to contribute and support the work of His ministry, and to be generous in helping those that God places in our path. In short, really all that it means is that we, when we approach our worship celebration, we should come as fully devoted followers of Christ.